From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This morning we speak first with Nate Peterson, historian, librarian, and co-author of a new book called Pseudoscience, An Amusing History of Crackpot Ideas and Why We Love Them, and why we insist on believing in things such as Bigfoot, astrology, and, well, the existence of aliens.
And then we have a conversation with University of Utah Physics Professor Emeritus George Cassidy about the history of the search for the elusive cosmic particle and Park City's role in that hunt. You'll be amazed as to what went on down in the Spiro Mine Tunnel.
Yes, stay tuned for that conversation. All coming up next on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
The Bermuda Triangle, personality tests, ghost hunting, crop circles, Mayan doomsday, Mercury retrograde. What do these all have in common? Well, none can quite live up to the rigor of actual facts or science, and yet they all attract passionate supporters anyway. Why do we insist on believing in such things as Bigfoot, astrology, and the existence of aliens? Well, here to shed some light on why we all love to believe in a few things we know aren't true is Nate Peterson, historian, librarian, and co-author of the new book, Pseudoscience, An Amusing History of Crackpot Ideas and Why We Love Them. Nate, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
Okay, what is it about us humans that we love to just hang on to these ideas that I think a lot of us know aren't true?
Well, we all want to believe the world is a magical place. I think that's a uniting thread. And I think that a lot of times what leads into pseudoscientific thought is actually a desire to have the world either be a little bit more interesting, perhaps, than it might be, or what you think of as interesting, or to conform to your own potential bias that you have about how the world should operate. So I think all of us, and we kind of try to approach this book lightheartedly and with a generous and empathetic tone, because all of us, including Lydia and I, the co-author and I, are people who have believed in pseudoscientific things at different points in time, right? I mean, it's fun. I mean, there's an element of it that's just a lot of fun.
So Nate, in the book, you are good about taking these topics and these pseudosciences and really treating them with some care. Especially when you start out with the flat earth theory. I mean, it's one thing to think like, okay, astrology is kind of fun, maybe, but flat earth? I mean, how is it that people can go that far down that rabbit hole, if you will, to completely disregard all known science, facts, and proof?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, flat earth is an interesting one because it stuck around for a really long time in spite of really compelling and really clearly visual scientific evidence to the contrary, right? So that's what makes that one kind of interesting, because of course, if someone brought to you a belief in a flat earth, you might pull up pretty quickly on Google an image of the earth taken from the International Space Station or one of the many photos that have been taken over time showing the globe is, or the planet is actually circular. But, you know, I think what's interesting about flat earth is that it persists in spite of that, because a lot of the people that believe in it, and this is something that's sort of true about pseudoscience in general, there's this sort of element of like, I need to see it myself. I need to see it myself to believe it. So whatever you show me, what you're showing me is just something that's been faked or has been produced by some secret cabal of powerful people that have an agenda to push that want you to believe that the earth is round for some reason, right? And, you know, we tell the story in the book about Mike Hughes, who built a rocket in order to fly up high enough to ascertain for himself whether the earth was flat or not. And as he stated before he flew in his rocket, he's like, I don't really even have, you know, a stake on this. I'm happy to come back down and tell you that the earth is round, but I need to see it for myself before I can pronounce on that, right? And unfortunately, in his case, it led to his death. You know, the rocket didn't function as would have maybe been preferred, right? There's a few steps that were skipped along the way in terms of safety built into that rocket in terms of the safety design itself. But, you know, that's a tragic example. He was a casualty to his own pseudoscientific belief. But I think that tendency to want to see it for yourself and to not believe what something else, something that someone else is telling you is a uniting thread you see across pseudoscience.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Nate Peterson. He has co-written a new book called Pseudoscience, an amusing history of crackpot ideas and why we love them. So you present this book as sort of a lighthearted look at these things that everyone really knows aren't true. But I would say that there is a very huge cadre of people out there who, like you're talking about this Mike Hughes, who unfortunately lost his life trying to prove his theory, they very much believe that this is true. And I guess it goes back to thinking that there's always a conspiracy. There's always something hidden that is trying to conspire against us. Again, like you say, with these powers that are greater than, you know, and trying to control our world and us. And yet you're trying to make light of it. Do you think that these things really, that like this whole world of believing in this stuff isn't real? I mean, obviously you've found lots of people who actually spend a lot of their time trying to prove this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the interesting thing about a lot of the chapters in this book is that these are ideas that persist in the face of pretty strong scientific evidence to the contrary. So that, yeah, a lot of the things that we talk about in this book are disprovable through the rigorous application of science, right? But like, are there things that we still don't understand? Absolutely. And sometimes pseudoscience stems from just a genuine desire to even push science itself forward. You know, science itself depends on asking questions. The problem that comes up with pseudoscientific belief in general often is not waiting for the rigorous nature of some of the scientific process to unfold and wanting to get to a quick answer or to an easy answer, to an answer that confirms something you already maybe believe. But that's not to say that there's elements that we explore in this book that won't later turn out to be true or valid or in some modified way or another, right? Like, we have to just give science time to fully investigate. Most of the material that we cover in this book that has happened, I should clarify, science has had plenty of time to investigate the flat Earth hypothesis, for example, and dramatically disprove it, right? But, you know, I mean, UFOs or UAPs, as we're calling them now, right? Sure, there's a lot of strange stuff in the sky. And so far, there's not been compelling evidence to suggest that any of those are what we might deem as extraterrestrial. But is that always going to be the case? I mean, we certainly don't know that, right? The molecules of life exist everywhere. It's certainly possible that there's extraterrestrial life out there. We're just advocating for waiting for the science to analyze that evidence to issue a proper verdict. And it's okay to give it time.
Yeah. Okay. Bigfoot. Now, a handful of years ago, I was traveling on some lonely Montana road in a snowstorm. My husband and I decided to pull off and sit it out and hang out at a restaurant. And we ran into this guy who was an artist who, like, 95% of what he did was travel around to Bigfoot festivals and do art on t-shirt, different kind of Bigfoot art, which was so fascinating that anyone would have that as an occupation or profession. He did not believe in Bigfoot at all, but he found that there were lots of people that would buy his art who did. And he found the whole thing light and amusing. And he even said, he went so far as to say, you know, some of this stuff is kind of compelling if you are gullible. What about gullibility?
I mean, I think, you know, if we're going to use the term like gullible, I would say that we'd have to also acknowledge that all of us are people who have been gullible in different situations, right? So we definitely don't want to be pointing the finger at anybody. And that's certainly not the intent of this book, to say, you know, to make fun of someone for believing in something. You know, I myself have had my share of questionable beliefs over time too, right? But, you know, I think that it's not even, you know, gullibility to me just means sometimes that you're interested in the world being in a different way. And maybe for you, that's Bigfoot. Like, for you, what makes the world more interesting is if every state has its own cryptid, and every state famously does, right? And that maybe that there's these strange, huge creatures that have somehow escaped the notice of science for all these years, and they're still running around out there. Like, maybe that makes the world more interesting to you. And so maybe about that particular thing, you're a little bit gullible, right? Or maybe your thing is UFOs, or maybe it's astrology, right? Or tarot card readings, or whatever that may be. You know, I think we all have something that to us makes the world a little bit more interesting place. And I think it's important for us to, when like try to acknowledge those biases that we all have so that we're able to better kind of better, more accurately ascertain where that information is coming from. And then try to sometimes broaden that echo chamber a little bit that we all fall into as well. So, you know, for example, if your tendency is to be interested in Bigfoot and to think Bigfoot exists, it probably doesn't hurt to also sometimes read some articles coming into the discussion from scientists who are arguing that Bigfoot doesn't exist. There's no compelling evidence for that, just to have that kind of more well-rounded view. I think that's something we all would benefit for around those particular topics that we really want to believe in.
Well, Nate, I think a lot of us really have a lot of fun with astrology. I mean, I'm a Leo and I fit the classic description of a Leo. And, you know, so many of my friends do, whether or not we interpret those characteristics, or could it be, we've always, you know, kind of had this argument amongst my friends, is that the actual season that you're born in and the actual season that your mother was pregnant during can have a role in how you, you know, turn out, I guess. But does it go any further than that?
I mean, the science was pretty clear that it doesn't, right? But, you know, it's certainly an interesting and fun thing to discuss. You know, Lydia is a Libra, I'm a Scorpio. And in the process of writing this book, we had fun with that. We'll talk about that together as well. But, you know, you have a tendency when you approach, and the same thing applies to like personality tests as well. You know, you have a tendency to look for these things that are being described as being you. And then that sort of is this confirmation bias thing, right? So then you start to be like, okay, yeah, I am these things. You know, it says I am, and I do act these ways sometimes. I mean, really, like a lot of the things that we delineate along those lines are probably pretty broadly applicable in different situations to all of us, you know, but the fun part is important, right? It's kind of fun to identify in a certain way, and it gives you like a fun talking point and a fun way to define yourself in the world. And I think, you know, the world's so big and large and complex, all looking for little ways to shape our own identities. And sort of astrology offers us one way to do that. That's pretty much harmless. I mean, you know, you can take it too far, certainly, but 99% of the time it's pretty harmless and it doesn't really hurt anything and it's fun. So, you know, I think that's important to consider as well.
On the flip side of that, there are some things that aren't harmless that people like to blame. You know, for example, Mercury retrograde. I know people that blame their crappy computers and their unwillingness to go get a new one on the fact that Mercury is behind the sun. And those kind of beliefs seem really dangerous. Like you're putting your future and your, you know, just your daily existence in the hands of something that isn't even real. What other areas of these pseudoscience have you found that have really caused harm to people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some really big ones, of course, in this arena that we actually purposely didn't delve into in this book because they deserved a more sober treatment. This book's kind of lighthearted. And there's certainly things like gay conversion therapy or racial superiority theories that are just awful and deserve very serious treatment. And that wasn't out of this book. So there's certainly examples of things going way too far. And of course, you know, in terms of topics that we cover in here, astrology, which, you know, is one that's largely harmless, but, you know, and I even said earlier that 99% of the time it's harmless, but, you know, they're just within living memory, there was a president whose wife was steering his presidential decisions based on astrological signs, right? Like that gets a little bit tricky. That gets a little bit problematic, you know, and there's certainly things like with climate change denial, for example, that there's elements like that, that are pretty easy to co-opt into like a movement, sort of like, if there's a certain agenda that a political party, for example, has, sometimes you can jump into pseudoscientific belief in order to kind of unite people around a vision that you're trying to push. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you can sort of use this for your own ends. And that's where it gets a little bit harmful and that we see the results of that today. But there's also more fun examples of that as well from history. And my favorite one that I like to talk about is when ancient Romans used chickens in order to sort of like guide their decision-making processes and both at the personal level and at the state level, you know, so in terms of like making decisions about battles and making major statecraft decisions, they would rely on chickens, you know, and that's an example of a pseudoscientific belief gone way too far. And the belief in question there is that chickens were uniquely suited to interpret the will of the gods. And they were thought of as being kind of dumb and thus susceptible to godly influence. And so there was a whole class of people in ancient Rome whose entire job was to care for chickens and then interpret their behavior in order to advise political leaders and military leaders about best courses of action. And this is where this is the process that leads to words that we still use today. So like an augury you can see the roots of that, right? It leads to inauguration, you know, an auspicious sign. We still talk about these kinds of things today. It relates back to looking at birds and deciding whether you should do something or not based on how enthusiastic the chicken was about some food that was left out for it to eat. I mean, that's definitely a more fun example of taking it a little bit too far.
Yeah, Nate, it's making me think about, I wonder if from that, where those why did the chicken cross the road jokes came from.
I hadn't thought of that before, but yeah, it very well could be, right? There's sort of a prophetic element there too, right?
Yeah.
Why did the chicken cross the road?
Right. I remember decades ago, someone was explaining to me spontaneous human combustion, and I thought it was possibly real. Of course, I haven't heard of it since then, you know, like three decades ago. So what is that? What was it? And how is it explained scientifically? That's kind of a fun one.
Yeah. So
it happens to you.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So spontaneous human combustion doesn't actually exist, but human combustion exists. And sometimes that can appear spontaneous, and that leads to this whole sort of series of pseudoscientific belief on how people potentially combust. But really that stems out of the late 18th century. The scientists for the first time ever they were able to extract oxygen and figured out that oxygen was necessary both for breathing and for combustion, for the continual creation of flames. And it led to this theory for a while, which I actually think is kind of a beautiful theory. It's totally false, but this theory that breathing was actually a form of combustion, so that your lungs had these little campfires basically spread out all along inside of your lungs, and that the process of breathing in added fuel literally to the fire of your lungs, which is, I love kind of picturing that, right? Like all these little fires burning away in your lungs. But the problem, of course, is that if you actually think that, then it's hardly a step away from that to think that, gosh, people can burst into flames pretty easily in that case. And a way that people thought that happened is by drinking a lot of alcohol, you know, because alcohol and flames don't mix, right? And so if you're an alcoholic, if you're drinking in excess and you have all these fires burning away to kind of keep your body running inside, that's a bad combination. And that leads sometimes, people thought that led sometimes to bursting into flames. But, you know, really that's something that pops up still to this day. Even I think about 10 or 12 years ago in Ireland, there was an official coroner's report that someone had died from spontaneous human combustion. It's because sometimes a forensic investigator will approach a crime scene and it's weird. Like what happens in the spontaneous, and what we would dub a spontaneous human combustion event, like looks really strange and scary and eerie, because typically the person is essentially gone. Like there's very little left of the human body, but seemingly the environment is largely untouched. Like the couch that the person was sitting on is a little bit burned, but not to the level you'd imagine relative to the body. That's because of something called the wick effect, which is pretty gross if your listeners are ready, or, you know, turn the volume down for a second if you like. But basically the human body operates like a candle in reverse. So it's like the wick is your clothing and your body fat is the candle wax itself. So as like, if your clothing starts on fire and you're, you know, and for various reasons that could maybe be a really extreme situation, your body fat and can in turn act as literal fuel for that fire and just kind of keep it burning really intensely in a really short period of time that produces like a really rapid combustion event. And then suddenly, you know, your body is largely gone, but it didn't really spread because the material around you wasn't as flammable as your clothing and as your body fat. So it's pretty gross, but unfortunately that's something that's happened and still does happen with people that are sometimes living alone or have been smoking a cigarette right before bed, and like that cigarette falls onto that, you know, things like that can happen still to this day. And it's sad, and it's a good reminder too to look out for those people in your communities who are living alone and who might be vulnerable, because that kind of thing still can happen, but it's also not what it used to be described as.
So this is making me even more curious about this, and I'm assuming our listeners are probably going, wait, what? So human combustion is a thing, but it's always from some outward source, like you say, like falling asleep, dropping your cigarette on you. It's internal combustion.
Right, exactly. Yeah, nothing in your body will independently of anything else set itself on fire. So hopefully that comforts your listeners and they can go to bed resting easily tonight.
Oh, sort of the, you know, horrible hot flashes as a woman. That makes sense. Let's talk about perpetual motion machines. I didn't realize they were a pseudoscience. You know, you hear about them and people working on them to create this constant source of energy and motion. But they are pseudoscience. How does that happen?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, so basically a perpetual motion machine is a machine that can run indefinitely without an external power source. And it's something that essentially we've been interested as long as we've been inventing things, right? So basically for all of human history. And I think, you know, it's A, it's kind of fun. This is another kind of fun one. And B, like if you're mechanically inclined, if you're like an engineer by training or by hobby, you know, the thought of trying to create this, I think, is a motivator, because if you were able to ever do it, you'd essentially have sort of disproven two major scientific laws, the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And, you know, what's interesting about a perpetual motion machine too, is that technically it has to basically last forever, right? So it's been proven to be impossible above the atomic level. When you start talking about like subatomic physics, things get a little more interesting, right? But people have been playing around with them and using them. You know, it's one thing to tinker around your garage and make a perpetual motion machine and show it to your friends. Where it gets a little bit problematic is cases in history where people would display fake perpetual motion machines and then charge admission to see it in order to make money, right? So like the kind of the classic con man. And there's a great story we talk about in the book about a fellow named Charles Redheffer who shows up in Philadelphia in 1812. And he advertises that he has this perpetual motion machine and he sets it up for people to see. It's $5 a head to come in and take a look, unless you're a woman, which you had a curiously discounted rate of $1 to come in to see his perpetual motion machine. And it was a fake. And it took the city of Philadelphia had inspectors show up to kind of investigate the machine after it started to draw a lot of press attention. And actually kind of a cool little aside, the son of one of the inspectors is the one that figured out that it was actually being powered by something that people couldn't see. So it was like this great case of bring your kid to work day that went really, really well, right? But anyway, so they disproved it. They said, yeah, this is an actual perpetual motion machine. But then this guy is like, okay, no problem. I'm going to just slip away from Philadelphia. And then a week or two later, he shows up in New York City and just starts doing the same thing again. And you know, that in that case, he runs into a really famous engineer in those days, Robert Fulton, who challenges him to basically let him, Robert Fulton, disprove that this thing is a real perpetual motion machine. And kind of strangely, Charles Redheffer said, okay, yeah, go ahead and try to disprove it. And immediately, Robert Fulton identified this sort of hidden catgut wire that was running from the machine behind a wall and up to the second floor of the building that this machine was displayed in. So he followed the thread of this, and sure enough, he came across a hidden man who was kind of amusingly trying to eat a loaf of bread while also like run this hand crank that was keeping the perpetual motion machine going. So the reason Robert Fulton had thought this is kind of shady is because the machine seemed to like be kind of jerky in its motions. It wasn't steady. And it turns out it's because this guy that was operating it was trying to like eat bread and run a machine at the same time. So anyway. It's kind of funny, but also a bit of a scam, you know, in a way that he was profiting off of people's interest in trying to see something defy the laws of science.
Let's talk about crop circles. I love crop circles. I think they're fascinating. You look at the geometry of them and the precision, and it's really sad to learn that they are all big human-made corn art, if you will. Tell me more about that.
Well, is it sad or is it kind of cool? Right? I think what we respond to in crop circles is A, the suddenness of their appearance. I mean, that really threw people for a little while, how you'd have this cornfield that was just a cornfield overnight, it becomes something else. You know, in the morning, suddenly it's this beautiful and rather intricate geometric design, which seems impossible to have created in one night by people, right? So then we jump to these other conclusions that it's aliens, or some people have even thought, no, it's Mother Earth itself, like the spirit of nature itself kind of trying to say, hey, take better care of me, take better care of the planet. You know, but I think it's important to not discount human ingenuity either, right? Like sometimes, and that can be kind of cool. Like I know it's not, it maybe doesn't make the world a more expansive and interesting place, like it doesn't prove that aliens exist, sadly, but it does show that humans can make really cool things overnight, you know, and that we can all look at them and admire them and enjoy them. So, you know, I think if you change your view on it a little bit, it doesn't have to be disappointing. We can also kind of celebrate human artistry and human ingenuity.
Yeah, that always makes me think as well of the Nazca lines in Peru that are similar to crop circles, but they're really incredible. And yeah, and it does make you say, well, yeah, you know, how many millennia ago were these people somehow coming up with the ingenuity to
place a very straight line or a design. Is it the same with the Nazca lines as it is with crop circles?
Yeah, I mean, so the Nazca lines, and I should caveat this by saying it's not a topic that we cover in the book, but from what I understand about Nazca lines, they've been co-opted sometimes with people that believe in UFOs as evidence of ancient aliens. This whole idea that aliens visited a long time ago in the past and showed people how to do things that were well beyond their technological abilities at the time, or even maybe did those things themselves. And these really gorgeous kind of both like literal lines in landscape and artwork that you see in Peru in the desert that we call the Nazca lines have been brought up before as evidence of these sort of ancient alien visits. But really, right, to what you just said, Len, they're really just examples, from my understanding, from what the archaeological evidence suggests, that of Native indigenous people in that region creating extraordinary landscape art, you know, at a pretty massive scale, way before we thought that was technologically possible. And I think it just does show that, again, that kind of ingenuity, the creative potential of human beings, and how we were able to manipulate the landscape in a very complex way, well before modern engineering takes place. You know, it's the same thing that people puzzled for a long time over how you could have possibly created Stonehenge, you know, things like that are really just these gorgeous testaments to the human ability to create. And I think that's what the Nazca lines demonstrate as well.
Well, our guest today has been Nate Peterson. He is co-author of the book Pseudoscience, An Amusing History of Crackpot Ideas and Why We Love Them. And Nate, it's a great book, and it just really goes to show the true creativity and ingenuity of humans to make understanding of the world around them. Well, Nate, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
We are all familiar with Park City's mining history. We enjoy the slopes thanks to our skiing history and role in the industry. And thanks to the Olympics coming back again, we get to be part of making history in our little town. But Park City has also played a role in the history of particle physics and detections. Joining us to talk about this history and their discoveries is George Cassidy. He is Professor Emeritus with the University of Utah Physics Department and part of the original team searching for these elusive particles. He is also the recipient of the 2002 Distinguished Teaching Award at the University of Utah and was professor of some of the most popular courses in the physics department at the U. George, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good to be here.
It's great to see you and great to talk to you. We recently talked with John Matthews at the Telescope Array Project about their discoveries down in Delta, Utah. But the history of cosmic ray detection goes way further back than setting up at Dugway Proving Grounds. But before we talk about that, give us, if you can, a brief introduction to particle physics or cosmic rays, what it is you were actually looking for.
Let's see. The original goal that resulted in the setup in Park City for us was by Jack Coifel, who was sort of the father of cosmic ray physics at Utah. And he's the guy that hired me to come here and work on the project that he had proposed to the National Science Foundation back in the late 60s. And the idea is that when a high energy cosmic ray, which is some kind of a particle, usually a proton, which is the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, they get accelerated out in space somehow, sometimes by supernova explosions, by rotating pulsars. A wide variety of things will accelerate protons, usually to extremely high energies, much higher than any energy ever achieved by a particle accelerator on Earth. When one of those cosmic rays enters the atmosphere, it interacts with an atmospheric nucleus, usually a nitrogen or an oxygen nucleus, and a lot of that energy in the collision is converted into hundreds of particles, elementary particles, a wide variety of elementary particles. And those particles go down a little bit into the atmosphere, and they interact. And before you know it, you have millions of particles created by that one interaction, and these particles are splashing down on the surface of the Earth. And that's happening all the time. Most of the particles are stopped by the Earth. They don't get down into the dirt very far. But there's two particles that do. One is an elementary particle called a muon. And that particle can travel down through many miles of Earth before it stops. The other particle, which is the one Jack was searching for, was an elusive particle called a neutrino. And those things are sometimes called ghost particles because they go through everything. There's not much that they interact with, and they do so very rarely, but occasionally they do. But most of them will go right through the Earth, completely through it. Wow. And every so often, though, one will interact somewhere. And there's a lot of them. For example, as we speak, each and every one of us has about a trillion neutrinos per second going through our body. So Jack's proposal was to go down deep underground and build a big detector that would be capable of every so often capturing one of those neutrinos. And hopefully we hope to make measurements of them, learn about their characteristics, what produced them, exactly how they were produced, and so on. And it turned out Park City had, as you mentioned, had a real history in mining. And there was a mine, as you enter Park City from Salt Lake City, called the Silver King Mine. And there was a tunnel that went 3 miles under the Park City ski resort. And it ended up being about, once you got in there, you were about 2,000 feet under the Wasatch Mountains. And in fact, it was right under the Thames chairlift. Back in the old days when I worked there, I'd go to work and we'd go in there, do some work. But the way I would come out is there was an elevator that was 2,000 feet deep. And you could take that elevator up to the top of where the Thames lift is now, but it wasn't there back then. And then I'd ski down to the entrance of the Silver King Mine. So it was an absolutely fabulous place to work.
That sounds like a great commute. So for people that aren't quite familiar with where George is talking about, it's the Spiro Mine Tunnel, which is also known as Silver Star by the golf course. And I know that in the 70s, I think it was also used as a mine ride. So you could get into the little golf cart and go back. But before we really delve into this, why were you looking for these particles? What was it about them that made them so enticing?
At that time in history, there hadn't been many detections of neutrinos. Neutrinos were first proposed to exist. It turned out there's a kind of particle decay called beta decay. And certain particles are unstable. And when they decay into a number of particles. And one of the particles that they decay into is an electron, which is a normal state of matter. Electrons basically are responsible for all of chemistry. All atoms are made of nuclei surrounded by electrons. And when these particles decayed, there was something missing. Some of the energy that was originally in the original particle was missing in the decay process. So the proposal was there was some particle that existed that carried off this extra energy. And it was given the name neutrino, which in Italian meant little neutral one. They thought it was kind of like a neutron, but really it was apparently almost uncapturable. But a guy named Fred Rhinus eventually built a detector near a nuclear reactor. I think it was in Savannah, Georgia. And he actually won the Nobel Prize for the very first detection of a neutrino. So Jack wanted to build a detector that would detect these high energy neutrinos. And basically, we were looking for an elusive particle that produced that neutrino. And eventually somebody did detect it. We didn't detect enough of them to detect that elusive particle, but the person who eventually did got the Nobel Prize for that. So we're about that close.
Oh, wow. What a story. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Professor Emeritus of the University of Utah Physics Department, George Cassidy. He's talking about the Utah Cosmic Ray Group, of which he was part, and he's written a book about the history. And George, it's so interesting because you say sort of in the introduction to your book that you have to write this book because you're the only one alive to tell the history. And so that's interesting in and of itself. What has happened to the Utah Cosmic Ray Group? Does it continue with neutrino detection or?
It still exists. And I don't know what generation you'd like to call it, but they have gone on to set up like Katie mentioned earlier, the telescope array down in southern Utah has been set up. Another offshoot of our group, a number of people splintered off and went to work on something called the Auger Project, which was actually established by Jim Cronin, who was also a Nobel Prize winner at the University of Chicago. And he actually spent a year sabbatical here at the University of Utah, really terrific guy. But he built this big cosmic ray detector down in Argentina and to look at the southern hemisphere, so to speak. And basically, a lot of the people that they splintered off and went to work with him. And then, let's see, there was another group that built the gamma ray telescope under the direction of Trevor Weeks, who is in Dublin. That was his home base at Trinity College in Dublin. And there were three or four guys that went down and worked with him. So basically, there's a whole set of different cosmic ray experiments now that splintered off from our main group way back when.
Yeah, that's so great. Okay, so you describe how 2,000 feet down in the Silver King mine, the project to detect neutrinos was developed. Obviously, or maybe not obviously, but you know, these mines, it wasn't unusual, or it hasn't been unique that you would go down into a mine, because it's like part of the work is done for you already because the tunnel has been created. Is that correct? I know I was reading about a gold mine, an abandoned gold mine in South Dakota, where they were doing the same sort of thing. And then the question would be also, why Silver King mine and not one of the other mines here in Park City?
Yeah, you know, the one in South Dakota was a little bit different. Turned out that experiment was operated, one of the people that was primarily responsible for that was a fellow by the name of Ken Landay, who was actually my advisor at Penn back when I was an undergraduate. And what they were looking for was something called solar neutrinos. Now, it turns out, if you look at the nuclear reactions that occur in the core of the sun, those nuclear reactions produce neutrinos. But by comparison, the neutrinos that we were looking at had energies that were, I don't know how to express this, literally trillions and trillions of times more energetic than the neutrinos that come from the sun. So the detector in South Dakota was looking for these low-energy solar neutrinos so they could confirm the theory behind how the sun works. And eventually what they uncovered was that there was a problem, and it was called the solar neutrino problem. And it was a big problem in physics for many, many years. But finally, what they discovered was that neutrinos come in what they call three flavors. There's three different kinds of neutrinos, and there was one kind that was made by the sun, but as those neutrinos traveled from the sun to the earth, they could morph, they could change their flavor, they could change from one kind into another, but the detector in South Dakota was only capable of detecting one kind. Later on, many years later, some other detectors figured out what was going on, and they are actually able to detect all three kinds. So it was a mystery that led to the notion that these neutrinos actually are even more complicated than we originally thought because they come in three different types.
Well, George, many of us have seen photos of people taking the train to go back and ski, and every story we've heard about working in those mine tunnels is wet, it's dark, it's cold. That does not seem like an ideal place to build very sensitive equipment. Would you build it out here, outside of the mine and haul it back in? Or did you have to go in and actually build these detectors?
Parts of the detector could be built outside and hauled in, but one of the main parts of the detector was formed of concrete walls that were 8 meters high and 10 meters long and about 2 feet thick. So it was a lot of concrete. You had to do that in there. So the concrete walls were built in place, and then we had to build all the detector elements that fit within those concrete walls and take them in. And yes, it was a phenomenal job. It was really, sometimes I felt like I was a laborer as much as a physicist. I mean, it was difficult.
Yeah. Well,
but I was a hell of a lot younger then too.
Well, and in the book you talk about some of the other hazards, like the tunnel will collapse. You would bring a number of notable physicists into the tunnel to be part of these experiments. How did they react to, one, the, what was it, like 13,000 feet straight back, it's wet, it's dark, and then on the way out, you know, boulders would fall onto the track. How did these world-renowned physicists react to this working environment?
Well, some of them really loved it and thought it was fantastic and just really enjoyed going in there and seeing what we had done, you know, 3 miles deep into the mountains. Some wouldn't even go in, and some went in and came back out and said they'd never go in there again. They would, you know, it was a little freaky. And for those people that had a little bit of claustrophobia, it was a real problem. And in fact, we had that problem when we would try to hire postdoctoral fellows to work with us. We'd have a prospect out at the university and we'd take them out to the mine and they'd say, nope, that, no way. And so, yeah, it was a real, you had to be pretty adventuresome to do work like that, you know, and not be too fearful about what might happen.
Are these massive concrete walls still back in the tunnel?
No, because interestingly, about 10 years later, you know, you've probably heard of something called the Standard Model in particle physics. And it is a model which is very successful. It explains a lot of things in particle physics. But one of the variants of that model led to the notion that protons, which is something that we're all made of, all human, everything is made of protons, electrons, and neutrons, basically. Well, the notion was that protons should decay. They're not stable, but they have an extremely long lifetime, like, oh, something like 30 years. But what would happen is the proton would decay, and part of the Standard Model predicted that that should happen. And so there were a whole host of proposals sent in to the Department of Energy to fund the building of what was called a proton decay detector. And there was a group called the HPW group, which was run by Harvard, Purdue, and Wisconsin, that got a grant to build such a detector. And the place they chose was Park City, in our old abandoned location. So they went in there and they had to rip out all those concrete walls, basically gut that whole inner area to build a new detector, looking for proton decay, to see if protons did decay. And the answer to that question is, there was an experiment in Cleveland, another one in Japan, and then the one here in Park City, and there was also one up in the Dakotas built by the University of Minnesota, none of them ever found any hint that protons decay. So as far as we know, protons are stable. That means we don't have to worry about our bodies suddenly disappearing.
That's great. So, George, I just have to ask you, you know, most people, there are physics people and then there are non-physics people. And the non-physics people have a really hard time understanding these concepts, even when you're talking in layman's terms, like you are to us today. And the talk about neutrino detection reminds me of, I don't know if you've seen the Netflix program, Young Sheldon, but it reminds me, he was at 10 years old trying to build a neutrino detector. And the rest of his family is just like, we have no idea what you're talking about. How do you turn people on to physics? I mean, you with the teaching award and really popular courses, how have you done it?
I think to a large extent, to begin with, the people you talk with, your students, for example, they have to have an innate curiosity to begin with. They have to really want to know. I mean, I always tell physics, people say, physics, why physics? Well, physics to me is everything. Basically, it's an attempt to understand how everything works. What's going on all around us? How does nature work? What is it, you know, that leads things to be the way they are? And that's physics. And you have to have a curiosity to want to understand the world about you. And if you have that kind of curiosity, then you probably have a good chance of really beginning to appreciate physics and what it is and what it does. But, you know, if you're not curious, if you don't care about how things work, if that's not a bit, maybe your interest is making money, or you don't really care very much about the nature of the world around you, then there's probably no hope that you'll ever like physics.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, yeah, it's all about how we can train ourselves to develop curiosity about the world around us.
It starts at an early age, I'll tell you. You know, little kids tend to be really curious. And sometimes every little kid I've ever seen is curious. Everything's new to them, they're exploring. But what happens? Why is it that by the time they're teenagers and, you know, some of them, they're still curious, but others seem to have lost it? I don't know the answer.
I can say from personal experience, by being a lucky recipient of your courses over the years, that the way you teach and the way that you instill curiosity in all of your students and people that you talk to really fosters a lifelong love of science, physics, and curiosity. Well, George, one more question before we let you go. I'm actually very curious about the Mayflower flies eye experiment that you guys had installed. Oh. I mean, I knew about the Spiro Mine Tunnel neutrino detectors, because you and I have spoken about that over the years. But I didn't know that you had set up a fly's eye detector over by the Mayflower Mine. Tell us about that.
Oh, boy, that was really something. I mean, to this day, I'll never forget it. Basically, we proposed the idea behind building the fly's eye to the National Science Foundation. But before they would fund us full on, we had to demonstrate that the technique of detecting high energy cosmic rays by the property of what's called air fluorescence, that you could do it. A number of people had really tried and it had failed, but I thought we could do it. And so the NSF gave us funding to build a small prototype detector and see if we could get it to work. So we did that. We took a year, we built a prototype detector, and we needed a dark place, because that particular experiment, you have to be well away from city lights, any kind of light pollution. Light is the enemy. A lot of light, artificial light, is the enemy if you're trying to detect very faint light somewhere. And so the nice thing about the Mayflower Mine was we could take our detector out there and have its back up against the Wasatch Mountains. And that blocked out a lot of the light from Salt Lake City. So back then, Heber was a little tiny spot. It's nothing like it is now. And it was really dark out there, beautifully dark. And so we took our detectors out there. We set them up. And, oh, within minutes after we set them up, we detected a cosmic ray. We detected a cosmic ray traveling, the shower of particles that it made that gave off light as they went through the atmosphere. And we detected the light from those particles and were able to track the cosmic ray as it progressed through the atmosphere. That had never been done. And that, I'll never forget when we had a little light display that you could effectively see what was going on. And it was the first time anybody had ever seen that. You know, there were four of us out there, and we were the first four people to ever see this happen. So it was really exciting.
George Cassidy, it has been such a great pleasure to talk to you. You've been such an influence on my professional and academic career, so it's great to have you on Cool Science Radio and to hear about Park City's role in the history of cosmic ray detection. George, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, and it's good to see what you are doing. Bringing science out to the public's wonderful. I really applaud your efforts. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. And as always, if you have any show ideas, let us know. We're always interested in new topics for Cool Science Radio. You can find us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And you can always find us wherever you get your podcasts. It's KPCW Cool Science Radio. Or visit us on our website, kpcw.org, under the Shows tab and Cool Science Radio. Take us with you on a road trip. Learn some science. It's always fun.
It is always fun. And coming up, we're going to have a fascinating discussion with the Europa Clipper science mission specialist. They have just sent out a little probe. Well, not little, big. It's huge. It's the size of a basketball court to check out one of the Jovian moons.
Yeah, really interesting conversation with a female scientist who is so amazing at what she does.
Planetary geologist.
Yeah, that's coming up next week.
In 2 weeks.
No, in 2 weeks. There we go.